At that point, I was kind of like, okay, I'll get whatever job I can get. And I leaned into the Salesforce one because that job had a pretty strong, similar personality to the boss I had, meaning I was looking for that mentorship, right?
That is James Ho, a Salesforce technical architect over at Google. I'm Josh Burke, your host for the Salesforce Developer Podcast. And here on the podcast, you'll hear stories and insights from developers for developers. Today, we sit down and talk with James about his long history with JavaScript and LWC, and specifically a repo he's got out there called LWC Utils. But we'll start, as we often do, with his early years, which, people, goes all the way back to S controls.
There's a couple of S controls. I didn't have to fudge with them as much, but like, the knowledge transfer is really, okay, cool. Here's a bunch of custom code we wrote on top of the Force.com platform. There's Apex, there's Visual Force. And like, my boss at that point said, I'm going to comment all this stuff for you and you can run with it. And I was like, all right, cool. And so like, my time was spent like poring over help docs. I didn't have a solid object-oriented programming background. I didn't even know what OOP was.
Oh,
and so I was like, okay, what is Apex? Help doc this, Google this noun. So like, I was pretty lost, but thankfully my new manager gave me the leeway to kind of self-learn and kind of figure out, you know, how much I was lacking, basically trying to get up to speed on like, okay, I guess Apex is kind of like Java. And what did I do? I think I just like, I bought some Java books and they didn't really help.
Mm-hmm.
So it was more like I had to find like working sample code and just kind of reverse engineer that stuff. In this like early part of the career, it was like admin loper basically. But I was barely even an admin because I had to learn all the declarative stuff on top of all like the programmatic stuff. And I didn't really understand at that point in my career that there was a separation.
Right. Right. Because most works in that day and age, you know, it's heavily sales cloud, some service cloud with some sort of customization layer on top of it, because somebody was like, heck with this. It's going to be easier if we just throw a little Apex at this thing. And you had the inverse of that, which is an interesting crash course into Salesforce.
Yep, for sure.
Now I almost feel like we could do a whole episode just on this, but how long does it take you to transition from that to Google?
Yeah, I had pretty lucky opportunities throughout my career. One of them was this first org kind of forced me into the fire, out of the frying pan, into the fire. And I had to really quickly self-learn, like, what is code? Mm-hmm. And that opened up an opportunity in Bay Area as a contractor with Genentech. And Genentech at that time was looking for individual contributors. So like junior developers and developers.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I had a little bit of imposter syndrome, but also a little bit of confidence when I was like, okay, I could probably crack this because I figured it out here. How hard could it be? And here's the really fun part. I did not realize the Genentech org was like super, super, super full custom. I mean, it worked to my skill set because I was already used to custom. But again, a second org, very little sales, very little service cloud, a bunch of Apex code, a bunch of Visual Force page. And that was a turning point in my career because I lucked out with Genentech in that the team there was a well-oiled machine. Mm-hmm. And so I got to see like the best of, okay, how does an agile-ish group work? How does waterfall work? You know, how does offshore work? How do you scale a 30-person team with like 10 or 11 devs? How do you like output three simultaneous projects and make it work?
Mm-hmm.
So I lucked out there in terms of like the people, the process, and just the culture.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's kind of fascinating because I think, so I actually contracted with a company while I was working for Model Metrics. Like they contracted me out to them basically. And they kept calling us in if there was like some really super weird complex Apex problem that they needed help. Sometimes it was just literally throwing me into a room with a whiteboard so that they could throw ideas at me and I could throw ideas back at them. Mm-hmm. And 3 out of 4 times, it was the project that shall be not be named because it was Genentech that they were working with. So like I feel you because they were doing big, complicated stuff on an Apex level, but a lot of people simply were not. Okay, well, talking about big, complicated stuff, I know you can't talk specifics about the innards of Google, but can we safely assume at this point you're just no stranger to big, complicated solutions on multiple Salesforce orgs?
Yeah, so what I can say is that there's a lot of leaning on the declarative here, but the solutions themselves are microservices that are very specific to kind of the function at hand. And so we go really deep into like bleeding edge, at least this group does. And I'm with the Google Play gift cards group, okay. Just Google Play in general. We mm-hmm. really like to push the limits on what's possible. And LWC were one of those technologies where I saw coming out of Aura as a way to solve a bunch of problems from Aura. And mm-hmm. we just kind of leaned into that. And luckily enough, I was given enough leeway to kind of make that decision and say, hey, I think this is the future of like Salesforce. We really need to invest here. Gotcha. And so like I took it upon myself to be, I think, the first org to push LWCs into production. And then following that, there's a bunch of stuff that I wrote to kind of make myself not hate writing LWC. And that's kind of like the genesis of LWC Utils, basically.
Got it. Well, let's take a step back with all the things that you were like, you know, you've taught yourself, you've kind of learned through the, you know, the university of real life sort of things. What was your past history / experience with like JavaScript component frameworks when you've not even LWC, like when you first mm-hmm. started going from like Visual Force to Aura?
Yeah, that's a great question. We can go back all the way to like the first company I had, the one where my manager left after 2 weeks.
Okay.
There's that heavy reliance on Visual Force. And mm-hmm. even back then, it was well known that like Visual Force was not very like interactive. And the only really solution back then was to do like jQuery. And mm-hmm. like, I don't think Angular was a thing. I don't remember. Angular was definitely a thing at Genentech. But at that company, I picked up a lot of jQuery. And that was kind of like, okay, I can't do this well in Visual Force, so let me just like hack some jQuery into this thing. Mm-hmm. Those skills definitely got upskilled as I went into Genentech. And there were a couple projects where like I wasn't a jQuery master, but I had enough to know that like, okay, generally there's like this thing you put on the HTML page and like interacts with the page directly. And that mm-hmm. was kind of like the extent of my knowledge of JavaScript. I had never used JavaScript directly until really LWC, actually. Because even Aura was like half JavaScript.
Yeah, it's been an interesting road for Salesforce, and some of our past episodes definitely kind of reflect on this. Like I like to wax on about how when Visual Force was in its first iteration, it was so JavaScript unfriendly that if you didn't space out your iterators correctly, the I less than whatever would break because Visual Force thought the I less than whatever was supposed to be a server-side tag. I don't know if you ever, so it was just like throw an error right in the middle of your JavaScript. Don't tell you nothing, just your JavaScript. It's just gone at that point. And then like, you know, you mentioned Angular and Visual Force, and it was this weird, like Visual Force slowly got better and better. I'm going to get out of the way. I'm really just an HTML container for you. If you can do your static resources correctly, then maybe you can use Angular. So it's been such a weird, like wanting to be really third party, you know, JavaScript component friendly to, and then Aura. And then like you're saying, like that kind of the design concept of Aura was still sort of, hey, this is a component library, but it's our component library. Use it sort of like next generation Visual Force sort of thing. And then we finally get to LWC where it's like, this is web standards. This is kind of properly how other people are thinking about component libraries. Okay, so you were talking about some of the frustrations you were having in leaning into LWC itself. Was there, and by the way, very on the nose, a title for the repo, LWC Utils. Mm-hmm. Like you're very specific about what you're working with here. Was there like a high water point where you're just like, no, I need to add another layer to this? Or was it kind of a slow, gradual, I'm learning these lessons. I want to get this into GitHub somewhere so that other people can kind of follow what I was doing.
It's the latter. It's okay. A slow burn. And the burn actually started with Aura. And mm-hmm. I had spent a good amount of time leaving Visual Force and picking up Aura in my first year at Google. And it was Oh, let me take a huge step back. Okay. Hindsight's 2020, but at Genentech, we actually were looking at some client-side technologies. And when you're at Genentech, you're a fairly large client, so you get access to some information. We actually asked a couple of people at Salesforce, hey, what's the successor to VisionForce? Is there anything better? Because we're looking at Angular to do certain things. And we were told, yes, currently use Angular or React, because whatever we have is not ready yet. It won't be ready for a while. And looking back, they were probably talking about like alpha stages of Aura at that point, because that was still probably bacon.
Yeah.
You know, hindsight's 2020. I didn't realize that was coming. So leaving Genentech and taking a little bit of a hiatus, then starting at like eventually at Google, Aura was, I think, about 6 months or a year in at that point. Like latent components in general was like about a year in or so. And I had purposefully avoided a couple of the components in the Aura section because it seemed very high friction to me to implement. And when I finally made the decision to like undertake the learnings, it was about the time when the Aura base components came out. Gotcha. And so they had started wrapping those components in the more friendly Lightning namespaced component area. And so like I was like, okay, cool. These are a little bit easier to use. I'll start picking it up. And I think the first 2 years at Google, it was basically just, okay, let's use Aura. And then I started slowly figuring out like where I was repeating myself. And I would start writing an app and I'd be like, okay, gosh, I really don't want to do this. Or like, I hate this piece about it. And then I stopped. I full stopped building the solution at hand, and I started looking at like, how do I fix my workflow? How do I fix, you know, what the heck am I doing? How do I make myself as a developer not repeat myself? And that's when I started to do things like, okay, if I had to do this like 50 times in this project, how would I want to type it up? And that was kind of my design ethos, was like, okay, I want to work on the developer ergonomics piece. Like if I were a developer and I wanted like some kind of thing, I want to do that thing in this way. And I basically tried to look at it from an implementation perspective and worked backwards around how to go about getting that usability. That was kind of like the genesis of the slow burn, was to remove those frictions that are like day-to-day, project-to-project, things you repeat and don't really look forward to. That started in Aura. And it was basically like pretty solid until LWC came out. And I was like, what? There's a new language now? There's a new framework? And then I was like, okay, cool. But what about all my Aura utils? And I was thinking like, do the same design patterns still apply? And lo and behold, most of them still do. And I think it was fantastic that like the LWC team basically said, okay, we're going to support backwards compat. And like the whole like composition, you can't put certain things in certain directions. That worked kind of okay. But it was nice that they were a little bit interoperable, basically.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm going to actually just throw this out where this is just sort of fishing a little bit. But when you started looking at what you're trying to construct in Aura and then realizing like some of the design principles stay the same in LWC, and then you re-implemented some of those things. We'll get into the specifics of those things, but just in general, did you find LWC to actually be like easier in reconstructing what you were doing in Aura?
Yes. So at a super high level, some things were easier and some things were harder, but for the most part, I feel like a lot of the frictions were solved by just vanilla JS and the fact that LWC kind of embraced that, specifically like events. That was super painful in Aura. And the message service like library itself, that was an answer to Aura's very painful like event structure. But it just so happened to work very well in LWC as well.
I remember many times during workshops and presentations, people would often come up to me afterwards in the Aura days and ask, like, which of these messaging things should I use in this situation? And I'm like, how much time do you have?
That was one of the things that made me write message service. I was like, oh my God, I don't want to think about like the whole mental model of like, what should I use? I just want to use this one thing.
Exactly. let's dig into that a little bit. And I'm taking some of this off of the motivation page on your wiki, because I want to dig into one kind of specific thing that you bring up, in that there's like a distinction between Lightning message servers and then like a third party thing like Redux, which is like a full state management lib. Like what does that gap look like, and what kind of features are you looking after?
That is a fantastic question, and question that I've posed to the LWC architects. both Kevins are aware of this conversation. Okay. And at the heart of it, any mature framework, I think, needs a state management library. Okay. I know that React and some of those were driven by the community, but it's like a catch-22 where Salesforce is like a very niche ecosystem, and I don't see any large player really writing like a full state management library on behalf of LWC. And, you know, to be perfectly frank, I think we're a little bit spoiled as Salesforce developers, where like, okay, cool, I kind of expect Salesforce to take the onus here and give us a thing to use. But like, I wrote that very specifically because I don't want at least my library or any other open source library to replace what I think should be offered as part of the platform. Meaning that when you start writing complex applications, you need more than like a glorified event bus, basically. You need some kind of like state container. And very, very importantly, you need a standardized API for the ecosystem to adhere to. Meaning, if I one day were to move on from Google and go to a different org, or someone else comes into Google, or you swap companies, it's very predictable how to manage your application when you write an LWC application. Right now, it's a little bit of Wild Wild West, where it's really up to the developers. Do they want to use one of the open source variants of like LWC Redux? Do they want to just bounce events back and forth everywhere? It's not consistent. And that consistency is what made me write that comment about, okay, this is not a state management system. There's nothing like this that I can advocate for. But here's kind of like glorified event bus for you.
So and I'm trying to think of the best way to ask this question, because it seems slightly obvious just based on the nouns within it itself. But what precisely is a state management library offering the application layer? Is it persistence of like events across components, across time? Like what's the cement foundation that's providing for us?
That's a good question. For me, a state management lib gives you a set of predictable APIs to understand kind of the state of your application. Meaning like, okay, if component in this random tree on the bottom, like, you know, it's like component four, child component four, and parent component one, like, I don't need to go to like different places to understand that, like the state of my application, the view layer, like what the properties are inside, the data it has, all those mutations and tracking is within the state management library. And I can more consistently ascertain like what's going on in my application. It's kind of like bringing it to one centralized area so I can always more predictably inspect that state to get an understanding of what like all the random components on the page are, like what are they doing? What do they see? What are they manipulating, basically?
So to paraphrase, a single source of truth that your JavaScript can interrogate without having to wander around the DOM or wander around the event structure or anything like that.
Exactly. And one step beyond that is that single source of truth is consistent across orgs using LWC.
Got it. Cool. Is there, I don't know if I can ask you this question. Is there a specific example where your message service component like saved your bacon?
Yes. So this is a super generic, one second, answer this one.
There we go.
when I looked at modals in Salesforce, like just the dialogues that pop up, the library that's recommended back in the Aura days was that overlay library. And even now, there's some like modals that you can do where it kind of exists on the DOM of your component. So it's a little bit easier to kind of deal with. But in the Aura days, the recommended approach for opening those dialogues, opening those pop-ups, was to go through that overlay library. What that does, though, is it creates a component that is really a sibling to the component on your page, meaning that there's no like direct connection to it. The modal body is completely separated from the component that created the modal body. And so that was the challenge. There was like, okay, I want to be able to talk to the thing inside the component. Like there's a button click on my page that I want to send a payload into that, but it's very hard to send a payload to a disconnected component in LWC. So message service, basically it provides that like thread to have you ignore basically component trees so that you can build pretty complex like UIs without really having to worry about, okay, how the hell am I going to get like this payload into the thing, and how do I get a payload back out of the thing, and how do I process like the thing afterwards?
Got it. Because whether it's a sibling or a child doesn't really matter, because you can just go back to the message service and say, hey, please go do this thing.
Yes, exactly. You just send it over the message service and magically it'll come back.
Nice. Now, first of all, modals are something near and dear to my heart, and I'm just going to point the listeners to the recently released Bonnie Henner's episode as to why that's true. It's a funny old UX design story, I'll just put it that way. But this is an interesting segue, because not only do you have things in LWC utils like message service to help components talk to each other, but you also have utility classes for modals themselves. What kind of things, other than what you just described, what kind of things are you trying to fix there?
Yeah, it's a great question. One of the frictions I had when using like the quote unquote official way to do modal dialogues was that you have to go through this very heavy library, Lightning Overlay library. It's very esoteric. It's quite hard to use. I don't think most people know how to use it because it's so complicated.
Mm.
The heart of that thing is it spawns dynamically a modal body through the old Aura API, the Create Component API.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it actually dynamically creates the modal body and injects it inside. Well, actually, you can pass into it whatever.
Uh-huh.
But like, really, what it wants you to do is use the Create Components API to like dynamically instantiate a thing to put inside the modal body. And I took the friction out of that, because here's the developer workflow that really annoyed me. Every single time I wanted to write a dialogue, I had to spend like at least an hour or two just with the infrastructure on like, I just want to make a modal on my screen. I don't want to spend 2 hours writing a bunch of boilerplate to make it work.
Yeah.
And so I really looked at the syntax I wanted, and I came to the decision that, okay, I just want the name of the body of the component. It's somewhere in my org. I just want this thing injected into the modal body. Mm-hmm. And apparently you can actually dynamically inject properties too to that modal body and have that all like work together.
Gotcha.
But that was all Aura. And I was actually quite worried about this, because when I started learning about LWC, and one of the things I had learned was, oh, they're taking away Create Component, like the whole like thing about dynamic instantiation. I was like, well, that's not good. But then I tried it with LWC and it worked. Uh-huh. And I was kind of like, huh, I didn't expect it to work. Like there's certain things that you can't do. Like you can't pass like functions inside that thing, but like primitive properties, like numbers, strings, arrays, like that all works as designed. And you can pass an LWC into like the Create Component API, and like it basically works. And there's a funny story on this where I actually asked Kevin V, and he wasn't aware that you could do this. And I was like, don't make this go away, because I need this for my library. And he basically said, I don't think we'll take away anything you can do today. And I'm holding him to that, basically.
They are generally pretty good about that. Yeah, that's nice. Okay, so moving on to another kind of big pillar of functionality you've got in LWC utils. And this one shouldn't shock listeners of the show. Like, I've got Greg Ruiz on tape basically saying that a really great data table is effectively the holy grail of JavaScript development. Like, everybody uses them. Everybody wants them to be super fast. Everybody wants them to have every feature under the sky. Oh, and also, could you have it handle a million rows without filtering, right? Like, it's it's like all the technical problems get thrown at it, right? Now, you've got the Sockle data table component, which, and I'm quoting your docs here, creates a fully featured Lightning data table with just a Sockle string. How exactly does that work?
It is, that one is such a fun component, because like, this was a friction that I had to solve over and over with my stakeholders. It's like, okay, they want a table. They want a table. Mm-hmm. They want a table. I was like, I don't want to keep writing tables. Like, I hate writing tables. It's so much like overhead.
Yeah.
I had to copy paste like this, copy paste that. And I was like, oh my gosh, there's got to be an easier way to do this. And I was like, okay, what's the easiest way to deal with this? I just want to write a Sockle string. And I started thinking about like, what does that even look like? Okay, if I need a Sockle string, I have to go like figure out the columns, I have to go figure out the data.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh my God, that sounds really hard. But then I started breaking down that problem into its components, and I was like, okay, this checks out. This is technically feasible. And then like one or two projects in, I was like, okay, guys, I have a really rough draft working. I think it's gonna save us time. That was like 2 or 3 years ago in the Aura days. And
oh wow.
Like basically what it really does is you take a Sockle string and then I do some checks on it for you to make sure it's compilable. Mm-hmm. And then I break down the Sockle string for you into its components. There's a little bit of regex, but there's also a little bit of like guesswork where mm-hmm. I do assume you know how to write like a proper Sockle string. And like, okay, cool. If you give me a proper Sockle string, I can like predict basically the components of it to slice and dice. Mm-hmm. And then I run those through like FLS checks. I run those through, okay, do you have access to these fields? Do you have access to like this, like I think it was FLS is readable or something. Mm-hmm. I do that for you. And then I make a huge assumption around the data types for the data table cells you need. Meaning that like, okay, I'm pretty sure when you want like a number, you want like the number data mm-hmm. type cell mm-hmm. for the Lightning data table. So that's all like configured at the top of the class where I make some assumptions on the columns you need.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go through a bunch of like overhead trying to figure out how to construct the columns for you. But it's basically a server-side replication of the data shape that Lightning data table expects you to pass it.
Gotcha.
So that's the columns part of it. That's only the columns part of it. So now I have the column definitions in basically JSON coming back from server side. Fantastic. Now we need the data. And so for the data part, it's gone through a couple of revisions. I remember the latest revision uses strip inaccessible now, where nice. I go ahead and like, you know, try to do some safety for you. And then I go query all the data for you. And then I strip inaccessible. I put it back into a format that, you know, comes back to the UI in a way that Lightning data table expects it. And gotcha. So the key point here is I've like hard aligned to the base component. Meaning that I'm just going to remove the frictions around feeding the base component the data it needs.
Right.
If they change it, that means I have to change my library.
Right. But on the flip side, you are in no ways trying to like recreate Lightning data table in its entirety. You are mm-hmm. merely trying to, this is a constructor on top of Lightning data table to skip to the end effectively.
Absolutely. It's basically, I kind of assumed that eventually Lightning data table will grow in features, and mm-hmm. I just kind of put a bunch of stuff on top of that to grow with it.
So you also have a couple other data table types, like CSV. What are some of those other types that you have?
Yeah, those are experiments, really. I really had this vision in mind where there's basically a need for various types of data tables. The Sockle data table is probably the most like used for myself personally. Mm-hmm. I have the most use cases for those. There's been a very interesting pivot in the Salesforce general design where there's that one website, architect.salesforce.com, where mm-hmm. they had those guides around how to develop screens and how to develop like UI solutions. And in those guides, I had talked to Tim Pang about this, and I had realized that there's a big future for Salesforce developers to really embrace screen flows. Mm-hmm. And part of my library embraces that fully. But me as a developer, like, I've stopped writing bespoke wizards. Like, that's basically what the screen flows are for now.
Right,
so, like,
right.
I don't really want to write, like, seven different LWC screens with, like, a right. bunch of branching logic on how to yeah. arrive to, like, you know, screen three, bypass screen five to go to screen six. Like, that's super hard
right.
in pure code, and I don't want to deal with that. So I'm having the platform deal with that.
Right, right. And so, is this the flow wrapper component that you've got?
Yeah, yeah. But like okay. the genesis of the collection data table was, okay, if I'm a developer and uh-huh. I'm going to use screen flows, what things suck in screen flows? And so I thought about like, okay, cool. I have the architecture set up for SQL data table where there's like a lower level data table that you can put like more stuff on top of. Got and it. So the more stuff on top of was the collection data table, which kind of attempts to parse out like collections inside of screen flow and throw that into the base data table to display on your screen. Okay. And so SQL data table is kind of like a SQL abstraction layer to kind mm-hmm. of deal with all the SQL to pass down into base data table. And then CSV data table is the same thing. There's Got a couple it. Use cases that we use where like we want to parse the CSV and display something. Same thing. You do all the magic on top of base data table, and then you just pass into base data table what it expects to show.
Got it. Now you've got all this stuff up on GitHub, and it's also 2G packaging, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yeah, it's unlocked to 2GP.
Okay. So we'll obviously point to all of that in the show notes. I want to quickly shift gears absolutely completely because I'm picking up on a talk that you made this mistake of sending me the slides, so I read them. and I'm quoting, because you're talking about leadership in tech, and I'm quoting here as saying a good leader should be, and this is the quote, be the buffer, be the unblocker, be the go-to. And I got to say, as someone who's been both a dev lead and a people manager, I'm feeling a little seen here. Like what do you mean by that, and what experiences drove that?
I take this from one of my previous managers, not saying my current manager isn't awesome, but like... And he is. My current manager is David Liu. I love working with him. But those learnings, the slides, what really solidified the impetus to create those slides was in my time at Genentech, I had a really good manager where I remember very clearly in our one-on-ones, I realized at some point that he was my shield from a lot of the weird stuff happening like mm-hmm. politically.
Yeah.
And so like, he basically existed to make sure that I can do my job and filtered out the noise
right.
to so that I wouldn't get distracted or I wouldn't have to worry about certain things. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the buffer piece was it's about like allowing some individual contributor to focus and deliver.
Right. Right.
The second piece, be the unblocker, that kind of contributes to the, okay, how do you allow the people you work with to kind of move forward with their day-to-day tasks? And there was always a question that he would pose in our one-on-ones. Okay, what are you working on? What can I do for you? And then what do you want to be working on?
Mm-hmm.
And the what can I do for you piece, that was part of the unblocker piece where, mm-hmm. okay, I need to do task X, but then like something is happening, like Y is happening. Can you please help me remove Y?
Mm-hmm.
And I had found that to be really effective where if you surface some of these like troubles transparently, a good manager will do their best to kind of unblock you there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one, the go-to, that for me was like, okay, this is like a trusted resource. I can kind of, for lack of a better word, like spill my guts to them in a professional setting. Like, okay, like I don't like this. I hate this. You know, I wish this was better. Like, I want to be working on this.
Yeah.
And so you build that trust level up where you can just go to them for these kind of questions.
Yeah.
And if you have that trust level built up, I think transparency and communication is so important in that you'll see the root causes of problems and frustration. And like, if you remove those root causes of problems and frustration, one, like you're going to build a better team, I think. And two, I think there's just going to be less like turnover because mm-hmm. a large part of like working in enterprise is just the people. And if the projects aren't interesting and the people are really good, like you trust working with them, you like working with them, it's okay if the project is a little bit boring.
And that's our show. Now, I did ask after James's favorite non-technical hobby, and it turns out it's one That's pretty common amongst coders.
I game a lot. I game a lot. When I had more time, I actually liked racing cars on the track. That's a fun thing I like to do sometimes. Currently, I sold my car, but I'm looking for the next car that I can track, basically.
Okay, so wait, two different things there, like gaming, like video gaming, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Like, what games are you into?
Lately, I've been playing Gran Turismo Sport. I got a wheel and everything.
See, I was wondering where the transition was, because then you went right to actually racing, it sounded like.
Yeah, yeah. But there's also, like, just... I've been out of, like, PC gaming for a long time, so I've plopped into, like, my couch and console. I've, like, fully embraced that.
Nice.
But, yeah. Sometimes I whip out the wheel and because I don't have a car. Now I just race on the TV.
I want to thank James for the great conversation and information. And as always, I want to thank you for listening. Now, if you want to learn more about this show, head on over to developer.salesforce.com/podcast, where you can hear old episodes, see the show notes, and have links to your favorite podcast service. Thanks again, everybody. I'll talk to you next week.